Booster.
Go.
Retro.
Go.
Vital.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Greetings from Florida's Space Coast, home of the most skilled aerospace workforce in America. I'm Jim Behnke, and this is a special Easter Sunday edition of Space Talk, where for the next hour, we are going to dip into our archives and replay some moments from past shows that are worth listening to again. Well, except maybe for the final segment of the show, when I offer up a repeat of my April Fool's Day space-related story from last week. Trust me, if you missed it, you will want to stay tuned. Also on tap for this hour are snippets from an interview I did in February of this year with former astronaut and United Space Alliance President Mike McCulley, who spent some time talking about the space shuttle program and his experiences. And we'll also hear from one of my favorite young men in the world, my friend Garrett McCabe, who in December 2010 was a sixth grader that had just taken a field trip with his class to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, courtesy of the National Space Club Florida Committee. We'll hear some from reaction from him, and I hope be assured that the future of our space program is in good hands. Adrian Lafitte from Lockheed Martin also will be heard, talking about the Space Club and how important we feel this educational program is to our community. All of this, of course, is pre-recorded, so sit back and relax and enjoy. We will be back with a live show next week when we will invite your calls and email contributions to the program. To get us started today, I want to present for you a rereading of the inaugural orbital inclinations I offered on February 19th of this year. There was a technical hiccup and the show didn't get recorded, so I'd like to offer up these words again, which were inspired by the celebration that was held the night before on February 18th at the Kennedy Space Center in celebration of the 50th anniversary of John Glenn's Mercury launch, in which he became the first American to orbit the Earth. So here is my weekly broadcast blog, Orbital Inclinations, from February 19th. Senator John Glenn and his fellow Mercury astronaut Scott Carpenter spent the past couple of days here on the Space Coast to help mark the occasion of the 50th anniversary, including a very nostalgic and inspiring ceremony dedicated to all of the veteran Project Mercury workers, which was held last night in the Rocket Garden at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex. I was fortunate to be present at the gathering, and as I sat there, surrounded by all the historic rockets and other icons of the past, you couldn't help but think about the obvious, of how far we have come in space exploration during the past 50 years, and about how far we have yet to go. Back to the moon, on to Mars, landing on asteroids, visiting other planets, new rockets that provide cheap access to space, commercial ventures that take advantage of what's out there, and other opportunities that we can't even begin to imagine. All of those possibilities are before us. And all of it is possible thanks to the first steps made by all of those Project Mercury workers who helped launch that Mercury Atlas flight, which carried our first American into orbit a half century ago. That historic event was followed by Project Gemini, then Apollo, and achieving the goal, before the decade was out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth. Skylab, Apollo Soyuz, and the shuttle, along with the robotic exploration of the solar system and weather, communication, and navigation satellites in Earth orbit, all of that filled our first 50 years of spaceflight. What will the next half century look like? It's tough to see, and I don't think the picture we have now is as clear as it could be. That's because not only do we have a long way to go in terms of exploring the final frontier, We also have a long way to go in convincing the rest of the nation that space exploration still is a worthy dream to pursue, that our investment in space will be paid back many times in benefits that will help us live better lives on Earth. Unfortunately, even as NASA is pressing forward with plans to involve more commercial spaceflight in its operations and build a new heavy-lift launcher, I'm concerned that the wait may be longer than we'd all like, because our future in space, it's a tough sell right now. When Republican presidential candidate Newt Gingrich recently campaigned on the Space Coast, he proposed establishing a permanent colony on the moon. And people from one end of the political spectrum to the other mocked the idea, made sport of him, and suggested this was proof Newt is a lunatic and out of touch. Now, I don't care whether you are a Republican or a Democrat. If you truly believe that going back to the moon is a bad idea and that we should take care of things on Earth before we go back into space in a big way, well, then I suggest you give up your citizenship in the United States and move somewhere else in the world. You're holding the rest of us up. Now, if you want to have a discussion about going back to the moon and throw at me all the usual arguments against spaceflight, I'm ready. I already have the answers to your questions. Why go back to the moon or any other place in space? How about for science? For exploration? For inspiration, for learning how to do it, and mostly for all the still unknown benefits we'll enjoy right here on Earth. Why go to the moon or Mars? Because it will help us to be healthy, safe, and educated right here on Earth. Why not take care of ourselves on Earth first? Because we can help take care of ourselves here by going out there. Because the money spent on space is actually spent on Earth. Because this nation can afford to do great things like go back to the moon and do the other important things a great nation should do. It was that can-do spirit that launched John Glenn into the history books 50 years ago. And it's that can-do spirit that is alive and well within the space community today. It's time for our presidential candidates, political pundits, late-night comedians, and the rest of the nation to catch on and allow the rest of us who do get it to move forward and do something great again. The space heroes of the first half century of human spaceflight did their job and pioneered the path that has given us so much. But these legends, who are already written up in the history books, tell us we haven't gone far enough. There are new frontiers to discover and new heroes to be named. Scott Carpenter wrapped up the ceremony at Kennedy Space Center by saying, "We stand here waiting to be outdone." I agree. It's time to outdo what has been done before. And once again, that was the Orbital Inclinations I wrote for February 19th. If you'd like to comment on what I just said or would like to peruse other posts, they're all online and accessible via the Space Talk page on the WMMB website. Just go to WMMBAM.com, enter the keywords Space Talk, and you'll be all set. Right now, we'll pause for our first break and then be back in a moment to hear from former astronaut and United Space Alliance President Mike McCulley. I'm Jim Banky. You're listening to a special Easter edition of the Best of Space Talk right here on WMMB.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Banky.
Welcome back to Space Talk, everyone. Now at its new time slot of 3 p.m. every Sunday right here on WMMB. As many of you know, Space Talk was off the air for several months after I fell ill and spent some lengthy time in the hospital last year. As I went through my own return to flight with this program, I had a lot of help in making all of that go as smoothly and easily as possible. And one of the people that helped me most was Mike McCulley, who was very generous in agreeing to be on the program right away as I came back on the air. So from February 26th of this year, here is former astronaut and United Space Alliance president Mike McCulley. Let's set the Wayback Machine to 1989 and briefly listen in to what was happening at the Kennedy Space Center on October 18th, more than 22 years ago.
This is Shuttle Launch Control. Liftoff of Atlantis' fifth mission into space is planned for the opening of today's launch window at 12:50 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Commander for this mission is Don Williams. The pilot is Mike McCulley.
Good morning, Houston. PLT, comm check.
Atlantis PLT, Houston, good morning. You're loud and clear. How me?
Loud and clear, Frank.
I thought you'd be higher by now.
So did I.
Three, two, one. We have ignition and liftoff of Atlantis and the Galileo spacecraft bound for Jupiter.
Houston now controlling.
That's great. Great to have you with us today, Mike McCulley.
Yeah, Lisa and Frank. That was a fun day.
That was well. What are your memories of that day? What stands out still after all these years?
Well, you know, that comment I made there at the end about, or Frank said, thought we'd be higher.
Yeah.
We tried to launch the day before, and the weather was really nice, and we got in the vehicle, and we laid there for 3.5 hours, and then Bob Seek said, well, we got a thunderstorm. And my response to him was, Bob, it's blue sky from where I'm looking, which is up straight up.
Right.
And there's some little dingy thunderstorm over there by the SLF someplace.
But your friends in Houston said that was no go.
That was no go. So you get out of there, and it's hard getting out.
Yeah.
You just don't want to. So we got in the next morning, though, and it was raining, and they called us and said, look, there's very little probability of launching today, but we tanked the vehicle. You guys mind getting in?
Mm-hmm. Well,
of course not. So we take our galoshes on, our boots, and we head out to the pad, lay there for another 3 hours or so, all I wanted, I didn't care about anything except the clock going to zero.
Right.
and I kept watching the clock. And, Don would remind me to take a look at the engines or do some check.
Right.
There's not a whole lot to do as long as everything is going okay. And on those real narrow window is when we added in that extra time. So you just lay there on your back. But I just wanted to go, and we did.
And you did. And a few seconds later, a few minutes later, you did what every pilot is trained to do, right? You threw the switches to start the auxiliary power units, and that was really your only duty until lowering the landing gear five days later, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Well, we know you, Mike, in the community as a businessman, as a leader of United Space Alliance, and sometimes we like to forget that you – well, I don't know if we like to forget, but we do forget that you were an astronaut, wore the blue suit. Take us back to those years in the 80s when you were flying, and what still, after all this time, stands out to you about your experience as an astronaut? What have you taken from that it's still kind of top of mind after all this time?
Well, Jim, I often, especially with audiences when I'm doing a typical astronaut talk, I always start out by saying I'm the luckiest man alive.
Yeah.
And when I think about the things that the country – the Navy, NASA has allowed me to experience and allowed me to take part in. And then also my family, Jane and the kids, I just couldn't have done all this without them. But the those years in the astronaut office were special. You're with a very special group of people, not all of whom you like necessarily, but mm-hmm. they're a special group of people. The experience, the not learning all these things. The shuttle is a complicated, space is a complicated thing. It is rocket science. And even mm-hmm. though I had a couple of engineering degrees and test pilot school behind me, there's still a tremendous amount to learn. So you're always learning in that environment. You never stop. And that's fun to be in that position. I was also fortunate in not only, of course, flying in space, but also the jobs that I had in those years, which weren't necessarily the favorite jobs, collateral duties of astronauts, like being the representative to the program requirements board. But
yeah.
I learned so much. And so when I made that transition to Lockheed and to the launch site director at KSC, I walked in the door far more ready than many astronauts are when they leave mm-hmm. the astronaut corps to take on the business responsibilities, because I understood a lot of the processes, and I also knew a lot of the people that I met outside of the astronaut office in the agency and in the contractor workforce.
And that experience as an astronaut, I mean, you got to be pretty something special to get picked in the first place. But as you transition those skills to the workplace and into United Space Alliance eventually, how did you pick up all the rest of the knowledge that you had learned? We were kidding. My wife and I were kidding on the way over here. She's taking online a business finance class. She's got to do one more chapter and take a test yet today. And she's having some troubles with some issues. We thought, well, maybe Mike would get you help do some finance stuff. And you're president of a big company. Surely you know all this stuff. You know, as you transition from an astronaut to that other area, to that private side, the contractor side, you know, you felt you were ready. You felt like you still had a lot more to learn. Was it even as difficult as learning to become an astronaut the first time around? What was it like?
Far more intense. And I have to credit Lockheed. When I came in, not many people remember that I was the deputy as a launch site director for almost 5 years.
Yeah.
And so Lockheed brought me along in terms of my areas of responsibility in a really nice way.
Yeah.
They kept me away from money and unions for 2 or 3 years. They let me concentrate on operations and the OPFs and VAB, the pads, that sort of stuff.
Surely your expertise anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so I could build, and then they would send me to these corporate classes, and some of it would deal with finance. And so, again, I have to give credit to my leaders in the Lockheed world for the 4 or 5 years that I spent as a deputy, because they, by the time my boss left and I became the launch site director, and then I became the associate program manager and all these other jobs that I had up through CEO, I felt completely ready to walk into every single one of those jobs.
And the question behind the question then is this, you know, there's always this chat in the space community about, do astronauts make good managers? And some people make good managers and some people don't. But now you add the astronaut label to it. Does that make you any more particularly right for the job of management or wrong for the job of management?
Well, the way I always viewed it when I came down here is I walked in the door with a huge amount of credibility, and it was mine to lose.
Yeah.
And in fact, I remember after I'd only been here a few months, I saw 3 or 4 things that I wanted to wade into and change. And the company president and I were standing outside OPF 1 one day, and he said, well, how are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I feel like a kid on a diving board, just sort of bouncing up and down, just kind of timid about just diving in. Mm-hmm. And I remember Doug Sargent was who it was, and he put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, you dive, and I got you covered. And a little later that day, Honeycutt was sort of my NASA counterpart, Jay Honeycutt.
Yeah.
A little later that day in a meeting, I said BS to one of his lieutenants.
Mm-hmm.
And before I got back to my office, he'd already been called and said, look, guess what your contractor did? So I built this confidence. And like I said, I had the credibility. And fortunately, I didn't make any really stupid moves.
I remember reporting on anyway.
All of us have made mistakes, and I certainly made my share of mine, but the astronaut title and experience just gave me a credibility and an ability to communicate with people.
Yeah.
And the other thing was Lockheed in those days had great technicians and inspectors and engineers. Their management team was a strong management team, but they didn't have anybody in the company that could truly connect the dots from operator to maintainer.
Yeah. And if we think about pre-Challenger as sort of a golden age, you know, young and innocent, and then this whole period of discovery, return to flight in 88, really through even the beginning of the construction of the space station, which I think started a whole other era of operations. You guys were doing some pretty remarkable things and trying to ramp up the flight rate pretty good, too. What was that like then, I guess, is the question. What do you remember about all that? And that a sense of excitement, that a sense of what you were doing, that mission, as you carried it on to Lockheed and USA, what do you take after all those, and what can we learn from that as we move forward and start up another era?
There's nearly always a better way, and you got to be willing to try to look at least. It's so easy to say no to some young engineer with a good idea. Well, it's really easy to say, now we're going to do it the way we've always done it because we understand it. And those kids have got tremendous ideas. And I think the late, after I came down here at the end of 90 and up through space station until I left 7 years later and went back to Houston.
Yeah.
Honeycutt and I and Bob Seek led a charge that said there's a better way to do it. There's always a better way to do it.
Let's say real quick, Bob Seek, launch director, Jay Honeycutt, shuttle program guy, eventually became KSC center director.
Right. And we did some very innovative things, and a lot of it was because we were willing to listen to the kids.
And there you have some highlights from our conversation with Mike McCulley. Now, please stand by as we pause for our usual 5-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour. We'll take a break, let you get caught up on the latest news, weather, and sports, and then we'll be back with our young friend Garrett McCabe and a clip from a show first broadcast in December 2010. I'm Jim Banky, and you're listening to Space Talk on WMMB.
This is Space Talk with Jim Banky.
Welcome back to our second half of this special Easter edition of the Best of Space Talk here on WMMB. Now, during this next segment, I want to play for you a clip from a show we did on December 18th, 2010, in which my guests were Adrian Lafitte from Lockheed Martin and Garrett McCabe, who was in sixth grade that year. He and all his fellow sixth graders in Brevard County had just spent a day at the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex as part of an educational outreach program originally conceived and funded in part by the National Space Club Florida Committee. I'm proud to say I'm a Space Club board member, as is Adrian, and it was his job then and still is now to help coordinate what we call Space Weeks with the Brevard County School District and the folks at Delaware North who operate the visitor complex for NASA. And in the studio today to talk about it, first of all, I want to introduce Adrian Lafitte. Adrian, longtime Atlas launch director out at the Cape and now director of government relations for Lockheed Martin, is our man on the site, on the scene for handling this program for the National Space Club Florida Committee. Adrian, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jim.
Glad to have you here today. And you know, I've talked to moonwalkers, I've talked to astronauts, senators, congressmen, actors, actresses, a lot of famous people, and it doesn't faze me. But I've never been so excited and looking forward more to this particular guest during the last few weeks as my good friend here, sixth grader from Ralph Williams Elementary School, Garrett McCabe. Garrett, welcome to Space Talk. Glad to have you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, Mr. Banky.
All right. First line, and Mom breathes a sigh of relief. Also in the studio today are his parents, Paula and Dennis McCabe. And the McCabes and the Bankies are good friends for many years, going back to church together. And Garrett watched him grow up, and he's still growing up, and he's getting too tall. His sister Delaney, also in the studio today, wearing the same outfit as my wife. It was unplanned, but they sure do look cute together. We never had a daughter, you know. Okay, let's talk about this. Garrett, every sixth grader in Brevard County gets to go to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex and spend a day touring. Let's hear, first of all, give us your vision, give us your memories of what it was like, about 2 weeks ago your class got to go. Tell us about the day in a few words.
Well, the day was very exciting and very educational for me.
Yeah.
And we had a good time and with different experiences with the Lockheed Martin and the Meet the Astronaut and the IMAX theater.
So take me back to the beginning. You get to school, and it's not your normal bus ride to a field trip, is it?
Nope, it was not a normal bus ride. Because at the beginning of the school day, we saw these giant buses roll in, and we're like, are those the buses that we're riding in?
Uh-huh.
And then once we lined up and went out to the classroom, we're like, whoa. And they were definitely better than the school bus.
And of course, we're talking about the double deckers. Are they still doing double deckers, or was it just the one?
It was just the single.
The regular, but the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex buses with the DVD playing and whatnot. What did you watch on your way up to the center?
We watched how they had the crawler. They showed how the crawler worked and how the different tracks and
so not an episode from or a movie Apollo 13 or anything. They showed the actual real stuff.
Yeah, they showed the
good. Yes. So you get off there, you get paired up with your classes, and there was like three or four other schools there that same day,
And you did through these different activities. And I, the Lockheed Martin one was fun. The guy was really good. Talk about some of the things he did with you.
He was, first of all, the guy was really, really funny and energetic. He showed us some, he told us what the different types of fuel, I mean, the type of fuel that they used inside of the, inside the external fuel tank to propel the rocket up into space.
Sure.
And they also told, he told us how to count down in Japanese.
In Japanese.
Yes.
Well, you know, international relations is important. Okay, so now get to the good one. Get to the good one. Something about recycling water or something like that. Was that the one that got everyone going? I don't know, Adrian. Do you want to tell that one, being the adult in the room? The only adult in the room, I might add.
Yeah, basically what Herb Jamada, which is our Lockheed Martin person that's been doing it, he explained how you have to convert urine into water.
Okay.
So he's going through that process, but in the process of doing that, he tricks the kid thinking that he hasn't done the conversion and sprays the kid, obviously, with water. But it really gets their attention of how important it is to make sure that things are done correctly in space.
Garrett, you weren't in the wet zone, were you? In the splash zone?
I might have been close to that area.
got a little nervous there. And so then you're walking around. At some point, I know you went into the IMAX theater, of course,
yes.
Because that day I happened to be there. And you know, we have to wear the suit coat and all that and be professional and all that and say welcome and say all these neat things. But after I got done, you saw a neat science demonstration. I know that.
Yes.
And what was it like to see them play with that liquid nitrogen? Was that kind of
neat? It was really cool.
No pun intended, actually, as it turns out.
Yeah.
So they froze what? What did she freeze?
I think it might have been a.
I can't remember now. Did they do like a rose or something or flower?
I think it might have been like a flower, probably.
Oh man! And then so you get this flower and you dunk it in the liquid nitrogen and it instantly freezes, crystallizes, and then you bang it and it breaks into a million pieces.
And I've seen it on videos in class.
Yeah.
Because our teachers showed us that before, and just seeing it in real life, like. Hearing the crack and seeing the little pieces go everywhere that you couldn't see on the video screen is really, really fascinating,
wow.
If you ask me.
So what movie did you see? Do you remember?
We saw Hubble 3D.
Hubble, they put your glasses on and Hubble
yes.
comes live and all that? That's amazing stuff. Now, do you guys regularly talk about Hubble at all in your school, or was this kind of a new thing to you?
This was kind of a new thing, really, with the Hubble telescope.
Yeah, interesting. So now after that, you're off to where? It went... did you do a scavenger hunt? Was that part of this year's activities?
I think we did the scavenger hunt in the rocket garden.
In the rocket garden?
Yes. We had to find out they told us some what type of rocket and what type of person, so we had to match up the rocket and the person.
Okay.
Who flew the rocket up.
Okay.
And so we had to match those up with the different rockets.
Oh, that's so cool. That is so cool.
And just seeing the rockets there and just seeing the different size of them. From the different times in the space. It was really, really cool.
Being the sixth grader, you know, all that was ancient history when those things flew. Did it look like ancient history to you?
No, it didn't.
Really?
It didn't look like ancient history.
Huh. That's weird. So from there, what was next? Lunch at some point?
No, next was after the Rocket Garden, we went to the astronaut presentation.
Oh, okay. And do you remember who you saw, which astronaut?
It was Mark Lee.
Oh, Mark Lee. Okay,
yes.
Good guy. Real good guy, yeah.
He was really cool, and he showed us some of the different things that he did up in space. I think he landed the space shuttle a couple of times.
Yeah.
And he showed us that you had to come in like a giant, like they did. I didn't know that they had to come in at like a wide angle, like over Asia or something, just to
do what's called an S-turn, to burn off energy.
Yeah.
Shuttle, as you know, a big glider, can't just come straight down. You could, but you'd have too much energy. You'd overfly Florida. Next thing you know, you're landing in, you know, the Bermuda Triangle somewhere. So you got to bleed off this energy, and by doing these S turns over way ahead of where you're going to land, you bleed off that energy, and then you come down. And did he talk about the final approach? Because that's a pretty scary thing too.
Yeah, he also talked about the final approach and how you slowly came in with the aircraft, and then they hit the parachutes, and then how the parachutes came off, and they just slowly stopped.
And magically, magically, the commander always lands with the nose wheel on the center line of the runway.
Yeah,
I don't know how that happens. Adrian, let's talk to you a little bit about. First of all, give us a brief sense of who's involved in making this happen and the kind of effort it takes to pull this off.
Well, before I go into that, I think listening to Garrett, I can say mission accomplished.
Yeah,
the purpose of the program is to get kids excited about what we do, and I think listening to him, I can say we have met that goal.
Oh, absolutely.
In order to do that, the Space Club, like you said, about 7 years ago, decided that the best way for us to get kids excited about the space program is science, math, engineering, is by funding what we call Brevard Space Week. We decided 7 years ago that we were going to start with a $10,000 donation. And I'm very happy to say that the past 2 years, we have upped that donation to about $40,000 for this event. The significance of what the Space Club is doing is the Brevard School Foundation is now able to match with the grant the donation that we give them. So our donations actually double because of the ability to be able to get grants based on what we have been doing.
And that money, that amount of level we've been able to raise each year going up, not just because – quote unquote, there's more companies down here, but there's more of an interest, and they see a value in doing this. This is a really good way to give back to the community.
Absolutely. We have every member of our industry, USA, ULA, Boeing Company, ASRC, you can go on and on, all the members of the National Space Club, the companies have contributed to the program. And besides listening to Garrett, every year we get bombarded with about maybe 1,000 letters from the kids that actually went to the program, and they send it to all the donors. And it's interesting because we also have people that make personal donations.
Yeah,
and I have heard we have a person that say, hey, I received 30 letters from my $100 donation, and I had given more money to charity and never even got a thank you.
Yeah. Stand by now as we take our final break of the day. And when we come back, we'll offer up again a story that I told just last week in honor of April Fool's Day. If you missed it, stay tuned. You won't be disappointed much. I'm Jim Benke, and you're listening to Space Talk right here on WMMB.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Benke.
Welcome back as we begin our final segment of today's special edition Best of Space Talk on this Easter Sunday, where we are featuring highlights from some of our past shows. So far, we've heard from former astronaut and United Space Alliance President Mike McCulley talking a little bit about the space shuttle program, and my friends Adrian Lafitte and young Garrett McCabe, who was a sixth grader when that show was presented in December 2010, talking about his experiences as his class took a field trip to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex, courtesy of the National Space Club Florida Committee. Quick reminder before we play our last clip of the day that the next planned launch from the Space Coast is the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, which is set to fly on April 30th at 12:22 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. The Falcon 9 will be carrying the company's Dragon spacecraft to rendezvous with the International Space Station, and if all goes well, the crew aboard the station will reach out to Dragon with a robot arm, grab hold of the unmanned cargo ship, and then berth it to an Earth-facing docking port on the Harmony node. Now, this is all part of NASA's new way of doing business of commercially procuring cargo delivery services in place of the space shuttle. It's a critically important flight to not only the space agency, but also the so-called new space community. So we will be watching it carefully and discussing it on future shows. And now to end the show on a light note, I thought I might replay the story I told last week in honor of April Fool's Day. Do enjoy. In the far future, two astronauts, let's call them Charlie and Jake, names which have nothing to do with the fact that I'm always hungry for some good barbecue, have safely landed on an alien planet in another solar system, no doubt originally discovered by NASA's Kepler Observatory. The landing was not without peril, however. The planet's gravity was uneven. The atmosphere was filled with some strange gases and strong wind currents, and the ground was covered with exotic vegetation. all of which made it extremely challenging to find a suitable place to touch down. The heat from reentry was higher than expected, and that, in combination with some extreme turbulence, wreaked havoc with the spacecraft's various systems. Unfortunately, the first thing to fail was the ship's communication system, leaving the astronauts with no way to stay in touch with mission control or to call for help if they needed it. After landing, Charlie and Jake assessed the situation, took a sample of the air outside, and quickly determined it was okay to open up the hatch, get out, and explore this new world without needing the protection of their spacesuits. Charlie was the first out as commander and climbed down the ladder in a scene very reminiscent of Apollo, stepping on to the new planet for the first time, but with no communication system to relay his historic words back to Earth. Charlie decided to go for something obscure and quoted Groucho Marx as he stepped on the surface saying, "Time flies like an arrow, fruit flies like a banana." Jake couldn't believe his ears and just shook his head. Charlie was always saying the weirdest things, and Jake wasn't quite sure if his commander really had his act together. Sometimes Charlie would just state the obvious and leave everyone else scratching their heads. Anyway, Jake quickly joined Charlie on the planet's surface, and they began to look around. The sky was a reddish color, while the clouds appeared to have a sort of bluish tint to them. Neither astronaut was quite sure of the chemistry involved that would generate such a thing, but that was what they were there to do, explore a strange new world. In the days that followed, Charlie and Jake settled into a routine and easily went about their business. They found a variety of fruits and vegetables that were safe to eat, and they were quite tasty and nutritious. Although they were out of touch with mission control, all was going well, and the crew looked forward to blasting off for the return trip to home. It was on the day they were scheduled to blast off that the trouble came. All packed up and ready to go, the countdown clock hit zero, Jake pushed the button to light the engine, and nothing happened. Trained as they were for all sorts of contingencies, Charlie and Jake didn't panic, but their hearts started beating quicker, and they both got a healthy rush of adrenaline pumping through their bodies. As they continued to work through the problem, they encountered more and more difficulties. Nothing was working as it was supposed to. As the situation grew graver, Charlie and Jake's skin suddenly broke out in some kind of a rash, apparently a reaction to their high stress in combination with the alien plants they had been eating and the air they had been breathing. Splotches of a sort of reddish-purple color quickly covered their bodies as they hit the rocket ignition button for one last attempt. Nothing happened, and it suddenly began to dawn on Charlie and Jake that they were going to be spending a much longer time on this planet. Charlie saw his reflection in one of the cockpit instruments and then looked over at Jake. The skin of both men had turned a completely different color that reminded Charlie of this planet's purplish sky seen at sunset. There was nothing more to do. The spaceship wouldn't lift off, and they were stuck there. Charlie looked at Jake's beet-covered face, summed up the situation, and said, "Well, it looks like we've been marooned." That's it for our special edition of the Best of Space Talk for this Easter Sunday. Thanks for tuning in. I hope what you heard was informative, entertaining, and perhaps a little inspirational. We'll return next week with a live show and once again give you the chance to participate in the program with your phone calls and email. In the meantime, don't forget our inbox at spacetalking@AOL.com is always open. And for one-stop shopping, you can just point your browser to WMMBAM.com, keywords Space Talk, where you can find a podcast of today's program, along with links to an archive of previous shows and an online version of Orbital Inclinations. That's all for now. Space Talk is a production of Mylas Solutions and is brought to you thanks to the generous help of our supporting sponsors, Space Florida, Boeing, Abacus, SpaceX, and United Launch Alliance. My thanks to George Medina for putting together today's program for me. Please join us next Sunday at 3 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time for a live hour of Space Talk. Stay tuned now as WMMB presents a weekend edition of The Best of Bill Mick Live. I'm Jim Banky, and we'll talk to you again real soon.